Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is computer world alcoholic Johnny Evans. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hey, hello, John.
It's great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure.
I found you to be a great technical journalist covering Apple, and I must admit, I've enjoyed your work throughout the years. You're maybe my favorite Apple writer.
I really, truly appreciate that. It's nice to have good feedback. You sort of tend to write into a vacuum otherwise, right? So it's, it means a lot to me to hear that, John. Thank you.
So you are not only a noted technical journalist for Computer World, but you also have your own website, applemust.com.
Yeah,
I want to ask you about, I want to ask you about that later in the show. But first, you know, everybody, because I've gone through this process myself of moving through different websites and being inspired by people. And it's always interesting to me about how we as technical journalists arrived where we did. I first met you through Computer World, but that's, you know, relatively recent history. What, tell me the story of what led up to landing the job at Computer World.
Well, you know, that's a long story. A long time ago, I managed bands and sort of did road crew work, and you know, I was a rock and roller. And
really?
One thing led to another. Yeah. And what happened next is I started, you know, putting gigs on and promoting events. And I thought, well, I'm promoting these events. This is the 90s sometime. I'm promoting these events and I'm handing out these pieces of paper promoting these events. And so if I'm handing out pieces of paper about events, why don't I hand out pieces of paper that are a little bit more informational than a leaflet? So that sort of became a fanzine. And the fanzine meant that I began to get a bit of a taste for writing. And somewhere along the way, I discovered Macs, which I still think are the best machines for creative people to do creative things.
Tell me about that. What got you hooked on Macs?
You know, it was an LC2, my first Mac. A friend of mine bought one for me. He was a graphic designer. I'd been working with Macs at his offices when I was trying to put my magazines together. And so I kind of got into it. It was Photoshop One. It was the early days of the internet. It was, you know, it was kind of then, that if that kind of dates it at all. I couldn't put my finger on the date now. It is a long time ago. So I got into Macs. Got really enthusiastic about Macs. Got a bit too enthusiastic for Civilization, but that's a problem I return to from time to time. They're sort of real RTS strategy games. And and then one day an advertisement for a news editor at Macworld in the UK popped up. So I applied and I got the job. And I suppose that's really in 99 where I start writing about Apple for a living.
That's about when I started too. Yeah.
So that's where I begin.
Well, you were pretty lucky to have not a lot of journalism experience or writing experience to land that job. What do you think helped?
I think I've heard various apocryphal rumors as to what helped there, but I think they just wanted someone who wasn't boring.
Well, you know, a music background helps with that. Our Brian Chaffin and Paul Kent and Chris Breen are in a band, and Bob Levitis is a musician. I've noticed a lot of the Apple writers have a music background. There must be some connection between the ability to play music and the ability to think musically and lyrically and be entertaining. I don't know. I have no musical talent whatsoever. I survived, but I don't know how.
Yeah, but your signature tune's pretty catchy, so you obviously got an ear for it. All it takes is an ear for creativity, right? Just a feeling for where the energy is and the stuff that you like. Aesthetic sense. You don't need to make it to feel it.
What helps me in my background is my physics career in astronautics and other research work that I hope brings a sort of a technical aspect to my writing because of my career. So that's the only thing that saves me.
It's a tall mess.
I remember when I was at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, I was reading Mac Week every week. And I was really inspired by Henry Knorr and Don Crabb. Don Crabb is no longer with us, regrettably, but he was a great writer. And also Robert X. Cringely, who wrote for InfoWorld and later. So, you know, there were writers who inspired me to, I thought, it's not only cool what they do, but I think I can do that too. Did you feel that way about anybody? I'm not asking you to play favorites, but...
No, I don't think I can, but it's sort of, you know, writers who inspire me are people like Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, it's and anything that I write is a pale reflection on what I really think is good literature. So, you know, I wouldn't ever like to... The trouble with following your heroes is when you meet them, it always goes wrong. When I read everybody that you read, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to rattle off the names. There's been people across the years who've come to, who've done things. I mean, I remember Stan Flack and Mac Minnitt and his tragic and untimely early death and the sadness that created across the industry, because he was such an important person in terms of the evolution of Mac Week and of Mac Publishing, if you like, back in the day. And of course, he's no longer with us either. And he was another cool person. I remember, you know, there have been so many people. And each of them, in their way, have had to kind of help turn the wheel a little bit, haven't they?
Yeah.
Turn the wheel. And whoever I choose, I will miss someone. And so, is that an evasive answer? I think it might be. I like the Macalope. He makes me laugh. He's so rude.
He's always good. Yeah. And nobody's figured out who that is yet, so far as I know. I was asking the TMO staff the other day, have we, after all these years, do we have a hint? No, we don't know who that is.
I follow the Twitter feed, you know, and one can from time to time detect people who've got a turn of phrase which is particularly bullish, which might remind you of them, but no one has any actual proof. Do they exist?
No, my working theory is that it's Jason Snell, but we'll see. You call yourself an appleholic, and you write, that's an imagined person who thinks about what Apple's doing and where it's going. One of the things I admired about you is you seem to remain steadfast in your enthusiasm for Apple. I can't recall you ever having written a negative article, even if Apple screwed up badly. Is that a conscious thing with you?
No, not really. I have written negative articles, but I tend to remain enthusiastic and optimistic.
I try to, too, but Apple's had its problems lately. We'll get into that later. I wanted to ask you about, because you're so prolific and you're so technically deep, how does your work day go? Do you have to write every day for Computer World, or do you have whole days off where you can do research and not have to write?
I write every day. I wake up, I crawl out of my pit early in the morning. I begin researching straight away. Really, my day tends to be look at the feed, see what's happening, check mm-hmm. the news sites, try to look for anything which might be, you know, which might be possible to put a bit of an original slant on it and try and find something useful to say. Sometimes you know what you're going to say. Other days you do actually have to actively try to find something to say. And at some level, I try to synthesize reality and put it into what I see as some kind of a narrative of if you like, Apple events. Yeah. Because there are Apple events, there is a momentum, there is a direction, and it's quite astonishing when you sort of sit back, or even, I suppose, jump in and try to tie the different dots together, how you can tie so many dots together, and over time you can see that you're probably never 100% right, but you're certainly never 100% wrong, and this is quite reassuring to me.
Yeah, it's reassuring to me too, because we all have our opinions, and we think, oh my, have I overstepped the bounds, or have I been technical enough, or... mature enough and experienced enough to entice the readers and to be a respectable writer. So, yeah, that's always a challenge. Do you keep America hours to stay in sync, or do you keep local hours?
I keep weird hours anyway. I'm an insomniac, so it's I have more difficulty getting to sleep than I do even working American time. But I am fortunate in that most of the people I work with understand that I'm in the UK, so there are windows where you can do the communication, right? So, mm-hmm. so that's what I use.
Do you know Kirk McElhern?
Not personally, no.
I think he's on Stratford-on-Avon, but north.
He's not far from me. I keep an eye on him using the Twittergram, mm-hmm. the Twitter machine. But again, I've always kind of felt that being a little bit out of the core is a good place to be as well. So I kind of try to maintain a certain independence. My friends aren't Mac journalists, you know, no offense to anybody, but they're not. I think it's good to try to maintain some humanity within it all. I am actually a human being too, you know, so it's, when I go out drinking, I don't think I spend a great deal of time talking about Apple events because most of my friends aren't that interested. And I think that's a good grounding thing.
Oh, now you've opened the door. Now you've opened the door. Mm. Now I can ask you about single malt scotch.
You can ask. Oh, like I've been forcibly banned from taking it. It's at some point, I think, as soon as I turned 50, I began to find that the single malts didn't work with me quite as well. So nowadays, I'm quite a fan of a halfway decent French red. That's nice. Good. But yeah, the alcohol caught out with me. I put that down to a misspent youth. maybe it was wisely spent. Who knows?
Sometimes it keeps those neurons working.
But you know, a good malt is always a pleasure.
So you said you've been writing for Computer World for 18 years, since 1999?
No, I was writing for Macworld in 1999.
Oh, Macworld, okay.
I started writing with Computer World in, I think, 2010.
2010, 7 years. That's a pretty long tenure. I'm curious, what inspired you to launch AppleMust.com?
I was a bit bored, so I thought it might be funny. At the time, it was going to be some like vicious rebuttals, but it's sort of changed. I think I started it maybe 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and started getting more serious about it last year. I see it as sort of like a space for a canvas for writing about other things, which perhaps I wouldn't get to write about otherwise.
Does Computer World specify to you about the things they'd like you to talk to write about, and that constrains you, or?
I'm not constrained by Computer World. There are some things which I won't cover because I know they wouldn't want it. I mean, you learn about people over time, right? Mm-hmm. So I've got a fairly free rein what I write.
That's nice.
Most of the time I kind of like it like that. I prefer writing with a free rein. It's what I've done most of my writing career.
Yeah, me too. I'm lucky to have that too.
You know, so I was a news editor. I got to decide.
At Apple Must, you say, we hope here you'll find out what people who should know better think about what Apple should do or will do or even must do. And sometimes we'll tell you what it has done. So as you said, maybe you were thinking about a rebuttal to people who are wild-eyed fanatics who keep telling Apple what to do, and it's not so smart, but you've settled out to, as you said, different kind of analysis. Tell me more.
I don't quite know how to answer that question. Is that evasive? I think it might be. Is there more to say about that? We have lots and lots of great websites, don't we? We're quite spoiled on the Mac web.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see any interest in trying to be any of them. I don't have the bandwidth all the time. Apple Must is its own distinct little voice within the internet for maybe a different way of looking at that, and a few good hints along the way.
You bring some great perspectives to your writing.
Just a few bits and pieces.
Yeah. So what are you talking to me on? What kind of Macs and Apple products do you have?
Oh, I'm using a little 9.7-inch iPad Pro for the Skype conversation. I can see your face up there on the display. And I've got one of the MacBook Pro, you know, with the touch bar, which mm-hmm. I've got on the desk at the moment.
Nice.
One thing I have done with the touch bar is take the Siri icon and swap it from the far right, where I kept accidentally touching it when my clumsy fingers tried to hit the backspace button, which I do a lot because I'm such an awful typist, and swap it for a mission control button, which has made life really easy. It's wonderful.
Do you have an iPhone too?
Yeah, I'm only on a 6. No, is it a 6S? What is this? Is that a 6S?
That's not
6S. I skipped 7 because, unfortunately, money skipped me that year.
It's time to start saving up for that 8 or the iPhone edition or whatever it's going to be called, because it's going to be expensive. Although, you know, it's interesting. I've read that some IHS people have told me that an OLED screen that's 4.7 inches diagonally is not significantly more expensive than an LCD display of 4.7 of the same size. So I'm trying to figure out where the perceived extra cost, maybe it's going to be a bust and, you know, it won't be that much more expensive. Or maybe Apple will try to fool people into thinking, oh my God, it's got an OLED screen. We have to charge you hundreds more. I don't know.
I think it will be the best phone you can get for $999.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. 10th anniversary phone. I'll make a big fuss of that.
But, you know, at the same time, Apple have a tendency of, you know, we know that Apple might just change the narrative. We may all wake up later this year to find that what's happened is that there was no 10th anniversary phone this year.
Oh.
Just because it's the 10th anniversary.
The
counterintuitive thing with Apple always exists. And the number of times I raise this and then I've got to try and justify it. So that's a problem. But I'm sure if we put our minds together, we could think of a number of times that we thought Apple would be doing something. Yes. Everybody got excited thinking they were going to do it and they didn't do it.
And so, we're so disappointed Apple didn't meet our own expectations. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. and where the people making the echoes in this chamber, and we've got to kind of, I think it's important to try to be, you know, it's like when you see the headline saying Apple will do this in, say, with iPad Pro launch in March, which didn't happen, suddenly it's late, and this perception is created within the narrative, which is actually, you know, it's a narrative about the narrative rather than actually about the company. So we all go a bit crazy, don't we, out here?
We're going to have to take a break right now.
Sure.
I want to take a short 60-second ad, folks. We'll be right back. We're talking with Johnny Evans. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm talking to Johnny Evans of Computer World and Apple Must. All right, Johnny, I'm going to drop a big jackpot question on you, because we were just talking about how, you know, there's an echo chamber and people build up expectations and then they're dashed and then they start trying to analyze the analysis and figure out why Apple didn't do what we thought that they were going to do. But there was an event back in October, I think it was the 27th, called Hello Again, where Apple really built up our expectations. And we thought this was going to be the revitalization of the Mac line, because it had been so long since the Mac Pro and the Mac Mini and the MacBook Pro had been updated. And so we thought there was going to be this grand, I think, if I'm perceiving this right, I think the community thought there was going to be a grand reset of the Macintosh. And all we got was a MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, limited to 16 gigabytes of RAM. And then all of a sudden there was this explosion. And I think I have some quantitative basis for this, because my readers started coming back at me and telling me what they thought. So it wasn't just my own perception. But there's been this gentle, persistent concern amongst the technical and creative professionals that Apple kind of hosed up the event, that maybe they were caught off guard by the Microsoft Surface Studio, that they were having troubles producing Macs at a continuous and periodic pace. And it hasn't quieted down very much until the recent announcement of Apple's plans for a new Mac Pro. How did you feel about that event starting in October and then amidst all this fuss from the creative professionals?
Surface, I think Microsoft have done quite a good job inventing a tablet for Windows users, and I think that's true. I also think Microsoft have done a pretty good job at motivating sales teams, and they're probably doing that in their typical pattern, which is to offer very generous sort of, like, you know, rebates to salespeople making a successful sale, which they've done before, right? So that's Surface. When it comes to the Mac, there's been There's absolutely no way that you can rationally deny that Mac users have not wanted new Macs for years. Don't forget that even with the Mac Pro mea culpa that Apple committed to the other day, the time frame in which the Mac, the professional desktop range, hasn't been updated is more than 3 years. We're only remembering 3 years, but it's 6 years. It was the same basic design, Mac Pro design, for 3 years before that, with no really significant improvements in it. Well, at least, actually, I hate that word, because significant so loaded, but it was pretty much the same design. People were getting bored of it then, and then they did the Mac Pro, and then they spent 3 years with that. So, why? Now, there's lots of reasons why. We could speculate till the cows come home as to why. But
you
let's
must
imagine,
have a few good ideas, though.
Well,
knowing
let's take it backwards. The one I'm working with at the moment is that, yes, Apple had the intention of migrating the entire Mac range to mobile. I think that there's pros and cons to that, to be honest. I can see why they'd want to do it. And my current theory, and it's only a theory, it's a pet theory, it's not based on anything. The theory that's currently coming out of my mouth is the notion that, having discovered that they want to get into VR and AR, they suddenly realize they need machines with a lot more power chops that to back that up. So I'm beginning to imagine that what's happened here is a slight change of strategy, partially in response to consumer demand, partially in response to whatever Apple's internal struggles must be, because there must be something, because something dropped there, and also because it actually fulfills a looming need of some kind. They make decisions based on lots of different reasons: business, customers, but also what they're trying to do with their platforms. They need a strong, powerful center. Just think about the HTC Vive. It needs a super powered PC in the middle of it. Now, we know that they're working that direction. We know that the processors inside of mobile devices are becoming stronger and stronger, more and more powerful, and eventually the distinction between what you can do with a computer and what you can do, for example, with a tablet is going to become less and less vast. You know, the things you can do with a tablet are, you know, the list of things you could do with iPad 1 was maybe 11 inches long, and the list of things you can do with iPad Pro at the moment is several pages, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the nature of technological advance. But what about if they needed a powerful Mac at the center of this and had to make about chase decision? Because when I look at someone saying, hey, yeah, we've got this a bit wrong, we're thinking about it, but we're not going to have a new one until like next year, I look at somebody who's just changed their mind, right? You know.
Well, that's the perception, is that Apple got so much pressure from the technical and creative professionals that they asked themselves, do we really want to give up this market to Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft? And somebody said, no, we're going to fight. And I think that resuscitated their interest. And as soon as that resuscitated their interest in the Mac Pro line, then maybe they started getting excited about things like what you were talking about making these new Mac Pros the centerpiece for developers and pro users to do some things that they hadn't been able to do before. My theory had been that there was some sort of reset coming along. I've written about it. I thought, well, what if they're moving the Macintosh line to ARM so that you have these binary applications that can run on both Intel and ARM? And after a few years, when Mac OS apps are running comfortably and reliably on ARM, then you could develop like a 25-inch iPad with an ARM processor that could run Mac apps with a mouse.
What if they're both true? They could both be true, John. They could both be true.
Yeah, could be.
I don't necessarily think the idea of a move to ARM and a reboot in those terms is necessarily exclusive of the other things that they're doing. I mean, we have this terrible tendency, don't we, when we look at reality, to look for unification, you know, like a polarized theory, a black and white, in which one thing is wrong and another thing is bad, and some things are good and some things are bad. You know, we oversimplify our thinking by making it one thing or the other thing, when mostly everything else we've ever done in life, which doesn't involve thinking, is a bit of everything, isn't it? So I think the tendency, I think, within journalists or people who write about things, let's not give ourselves too big a name, is to try to oversimplify in terms of, again, returning to the idea of narrative. But
Well, I think a lot of writers oversimplify because they don't have a good foundation, both a technical background and familiarity with Apple. Having worked for Apple helps quite a bit because it gives you some feeling for what they may be thinking. And my feeling is that it's a combination of inattention to the Mac line because of other pressing business, you know, Apple Park and legal issues and the development of the iPhone. And then all of a sudden they woke up one day and they went, wow, we're getting tremendous feedback. Let's fix this. But, you know, that's all we can do is sort of look from a distance and hope that maybe along the way there was an opportunity to do something really cool. And maybe AR fits into the future. How are you thinking about Apple and augmented reality?
It's hard to see how that will shape up yet. But Tim Cook's talked about enabling people who can't be there to be there. I think he I can't remember his exact quote, but that leads to a sort of FaceTime VR, doesn't it? Sort of like an augmented reality in FaceTime. And I also think that when it comes, you know, what is AR anyway? Is AR sort of whiz-bang flash experiences that dominate your thinking, or is AR what the word says it is, augmented experiences that actually add to your current experience? So I don't think it's necessarily true to anticipate anything which is kind of gets in the way of you and your reality. I think it's more likely they'll be looking for ways to add intelligence to your journey through your own reality, right? So
Google Glass done right.
Oh, Google Glass done right. But Google Glass is, I mean, you see it because that was, it's like so much that happens and has happened in recent years, all hype and a very disappointing reality. And then you have something like Apple's view on privacy, which is, oh, I mean, we've got to have encryption. We've got to have privacy because not having that undermines the entire evolution of future business. And AR would also feed into that, right? So it's, there's so many different levels of looking at this, and it's so very, very difficult to get a fix on what it might be. I imagine that you will see more and more experiences which you assume will happen on your computer or on your phone, happen in your ears with your AirPods, or happen on your wrist with your Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. I imagine that cloud-based intelligence to augment your existing daily life is more what Apple are talking about with regard to AR experiences, at least, than sort of like sticking a pair of ridiculous goggles on and disappearing from your whole friends and family into some kind of game-induced hellhole for the next week will be. But that's not to say that there won't be some of that, because it's all an opportunity, right? It's a platform evolution. So we are human, right? So if we're human at the center of the experience, what do humans need?
You mentioned encryption a second ago. You know, in February and March of 2016, Apple crossed swords with the FBI. And there seemed to be sort of a standoff. And then the FBI got diverted into other things. And for now, it's remaining to be a standoff, in that there's many avenues for the government to find out what bad guys are doing. But in terms of being able to freely poke through our phone, which opens doors to the bad guys too. And it's pretty much accepted, as you said, that we really need security and encryption on our phones. Is the UK government feeling any differently about this than the US government?
The UK different is the UK government is even more authoritarian. And I think that in the last couple of weeks, they're attempting to put laws into effect to achieve the same results. Given the unity between the two different intelligence agencies, you can rest assured that, you know, what happens in one side will happen to the other.
Interesting.
Right, you know, they'll just put the data through the UK first. Give you covered by UK data protection law, which means the government has, you know how it works.
Does the UK government insist on a backdoor, which would open our phone to the bad guys?
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Do you remember the big event a week or two ago, a couple of weeks ago, when that crazy man decided to drive a car, through people on Westminster Bridge and stabbed a policeman to death outside the House of Commons?
I saw that.
Now, you know, this was it's being described as a terrorist attack, but at the same time, it's a single lone actor, right? It's a lone wolf individual. So is that really you know? So this guy does something very evil and very stupid and very, very mean to innocent people who deserve not to be treated that way. Thank you very much. And the government over here used that as, I begin to use that as an argument to come back to the encryption debate, saying, you know, we want backdoors into WhatsApp. We want backdoors into Message. So this debate is far from done. It may shift out of the States for a while, and go to the UK or to other countries around the world. But, you know, it's like I've often argued here, if it's lost in one space, then we're lost everywhere.
Yeah, that's right? True. That's true. Does the UK have organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union?
Yeah, we've got Liberty over here and people who are ostensibly fighting it, but there's I'm not seeing the same kind of consciousness in this country at the moment. You guys seem to be a lot more switched on as to value of such things.
Interesting. Well, I hope we can help you out as a result. We'll see.
So do I.
Well, that opens the door to Tim Cook and his obsession with privacy. How have you been feeling about Tim Cook? I don't want to put you on too much of a spot because it's a divisive question, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about the Tim Cook era.
I think Tim Cook has faced a great deal of unwarranted criticism from a lot of quarters ever since he turned around and said that he wasn't going to value shareholder profit against Apple's responsibility to battle climate change. I'm not saying that I think that those things are unconnected either. Mm. I forget the calculation, but how much more is that company worth now since he took over? I think in terms of creating shareholder value, he's doing quite a good job.
Yes, he has. What about the product vision part of it? Do you think there are enough forces with inside Apple without Steve Jobs to envision the future and make it happen?
You can quite happily blase and say, hey, look, it looks like it's going to be all right. And then you have the Mac Pro instance. I think the Mac Pro thing is something which you could actually argue this wouldn't have happened under Steve Jobs.
Yeah,
but that's a criticism of that incident and not a criticism of everything. I think what we have there, we have some kind of a gap in terms of iPad evolution. We have the beginnings of a wearable ecosystem with Apple Watch. And indeed AirPods, because they're not just speakers, the headphones. The AirPods are not just headphones. They are also an access to wearable technology, right? You can click them and ask for Siri. That means you're accessing all that intelligence in the cloud. They're much more than a pair of headphones.
You wrote an article the other day about you might be able to ask Siri for a loan. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was today. I follow financial technology from time to time because it's kind of interesting. The evolution of banking is something I've been quite interested in since 2008, which is why a long, long time ago I wrote a banker's technology is going to get you and none of us are going to care, which I think is probably true. and technology is coming for the banks now. Sorry, I've just dropped a headpiece. So you can look at that and anticipate some major changes in how we access. Digital transformation is at the root of everything that's happening.
You're so
here.
Good at that. That's another thing I like about you. You're so good at technically seeing the future in a practical, optimistic way that sounds very, very possible. I like that.
2007 and the iPhone hits the streets, right? 2007 and Steve Jobs is there saying, hey, we're doing all these three things. You know, it's three devices in one. It's amazing. Look at this great piece of technology. I suspect you're going to have to cut all of that because I just shifted position. So in 2007, when Apple introduced the iPhone, it also ushered in an era of new connected experience. We'd had browsers in phones beforehand, but let's face it, they were pretty poor. People were very excited by gadgets. It's like the Palm Trio. And people had also developed some excitement about the iTunes phone, which ended up being such a flop, the rocker. So when the iPhone landed, people were like, huh, why is Apple making a phone? Or you had Balmer saying, huh, It's too expensive.
Because our phones were so terrible.
within 18 months, people were in their offices and in their homes, and they were demanding access to smartphones when they were at work, as well as, you know, within 24 months, we were talking about bring your own devices and the impact of that on enterprise markets. Android arrived, of course, and that's a whole different story. We could probably spend a day talking about that, whatever. What really happened is that people have become more and more accustomed to having access to incredibly powerful technologies in a pocket-sized connected device. This concept of connected devices is absolutely changing everything from the way we shop, where so many people go to the shops now, they pull the phone out of their pocket and they check the prices while they're in the store, to the way we communicate with each other, to how we move and how we travel, to how we learn. Look at all the apps there, the MOOCs, the Duolingos, everything. This is quite profound change in society, ushered in by connected devices. The computer was itself, if you like, a connected device, at least it became so after the internet. It ushered in profound change in at every level of human existence. It did. From 1967, when you had computer mainframes which occupied whole offices, to 1999, when it was an iMac. That was a big journey. Now we have an iMac in our pocket. Soon we're going to have an iMac on our watch. Well, we already sort of do. It just needs an LTE connection.
Oh, and, yeah, but that's going to put some stress on the battery in the watch. I have my doubts about that.
It will happen.
Eventually.
It will happen. Yeah, it's got to happen. It's an inevitability, right? So it's the technology is becoming transient, it's becoming ambient, it's becoming less and less visible and more apparent to everything. And that is kind of what I'm talking about when I talk about digital transformation, because that changes all our interactions. And Apple is at an amazing nexus point to profit from this, and yet the change is happening so rapidly.
It is. So are you thinking that maybe someday we'll have a really good connection to our bank or Intuit or something like that, and we'll go, we're pre-authorized, and we'll just talk to Siri and say, well, I'd like to get a loan of $500 into my savings account, authorization Picard 127 alpha 43, and it's done. And you just go on your merry way and keep on walking.
I'd go with that, except for the authorization code, because I'm not sure how necessary that would be, because Siri would already know it was you.
That's true.
So,
well, maybe it's like Echo, where you have to just have that extra level of security to, you know, I don't know. It's fascinating.
You may just need to put your fingerprints on your watch or something, you know, so devices can work together.
Yeah, it's amazing what's happening. Well, you know, Johnny, we've talked a lot and we've run out of time.
Oh my. That's a shame.
It's a shame. Yes. It's been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you for joining me on the show and taking us on this grand tour. It's been delightful.
I've been honored to be invited. It's been a pleasure to meet you in this virtual way. Digital transformation is everything. The world is changing. And in order to make sure we have a good place in it, we have to help define what we want it to be.
Yes. All right. So tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Oh, you can find me, Johnny Evans, at Johnny_CW on Twitter. So it's JONNY_CW, and that's me. You'll find me there. It'd be nice to catch you there.
Great. Well, thanks again for being on the show. And listeners, thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it, and we always appreciate you coming by. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.